Good morning. So last time we talked about the single instruction, multiple data instruction. So we had sort of one operation that we wanted to do on lots of pieces of data. And we had these instructions that would take what we called vectors of data. So basically fixed sized arrays that typically are going to be stored in registers and do some operation like addition or multiplication on every pair of values. And as typically implemented, the only way of implementing it, we'd have sort of an ALU which had many lanes, so basically was a whole bunch of ALUs stapled together. And this allowed our processors to support doing more computation without actually adding more machinery for instruction fetching, figuring out when we can run instructions, forwarding values around, and so on. We talked a bit about using those instructions. And as part of this, we wanted to kind of take whatever code we had and try to expand it, usually by sort of expanding loops in some kind of way, to have these groups of parallel operations that match that pattern. We had sort of like a bunch of plus operations that would match the, you know, do a whole bunch of plus operations instruction after expanding some loops. And as we were looking at some examples of this, we figured out, there's some other operations we're going to kind of want besides these typical just vector, you know, do the same thing on every pair operation. So one thing we wanted is often we want to like do the same thing to all the values. Like we want to double all the values, or you know, we want to like multiply them all by two or something like that. Then we have to want to have a vector of twos. So we'd like some operation to like take a value and make it spread it across a whole vector. Also, sometimes we want to rearrange vectors, that sometimes the way we read values out of memory, you know, is not going to be the order we want them in. And this is something where we're going to want some extra help from the processor, because, well, when we're dealing with like arrays in memory, well, we can like take a pointer to an element and do things with that pointer. That doesn't work for these vectors. We have this register that stores this little array. We can't take a pointer to the middle of the register. It's not a way of doing that. So we're going to have some, wants to have some help for doing that. So we talked about these in the operation. We mentioned that there's maybe some other things these, you know, our processors could provide. Maybe some of them have been ideas that have been around for a while, since although vector operations are relatively new for general purpose processors, there's an idea that's been used a lot in special purpose processors such as GPUs and some processors from before that in the supercomputing world. So questions on single instruction, multiple data issues? So our second topic, which is going to be our main topic for today, is sort of about hardware supporting running the operating system. And a big thing we have operating systems do is we have multiple programs sort of together on a machine. And that machine often won't have enough processors to run all those programs. And the programs generally aren't written in a way to actually do anything to make that happen. They're just written as if they run independently. So we're going to want to have two programs using one core, but the programs, you know, actually sort of are kind of written as if they're only using that core themselves, but no, not sharing it. And what's going to happen is they're going to end up taking turns. And we're going to have the hardware help out, because the programs, like we saw an example of our infinite loop, aren't going to have anything to say, let's take turns now. They're going to be written as if they have exclusive control over the processor. But the hardware is going to help run the operating system, and the operating system is going to implement the operation of changing programs. And as part of changing programs, well, the operating system is going to do most of the work there. The hardware is going to help out with starting the operating system, and that's basically it. We'll talk about the details of that later today. And we'll call the operation where the operating system switches from one program to another a context switch. And as part of this, we're going to have the context. And the context is going to be sort of all the information that's on the processor to run a program. So that's generally going to be the registers. It's going to be like the condition codes and the program counter. And also we mentioned this notion of an address space. So when we have two different programs on the same processor, they have memory they can access. And one way we can make this work is we could give the program sort of separate ranges of memory addresses. And that's something some operating systems have done. That's not typically what we end up doing. Typically, the programs are going to have kind of a fixed range of memory addresses, and we're going to also make it sure that they actually can't access other programs' memory. And the way we're going to do this is we're going to set up some sort of mapping that asks the addresses the program uses to the real addresses. And we'll call the result of setting up this mapping an address space, that the program has some set of memory that it looks like it owns, but that really is just translated onto real addresses in some way the OS controls. So our context is going to include that address space information plus the program's registers, so on. And to switch from one program to another, we're going to take this context, we're going to save the current one somewhere, probably in the OS's memory, and we're going to restore one we saved earlier. And we're going to talk more about this process of running the OS and address spaces today. Sorry. So before I move on to that, questions? Question, does having this address space implemented add overhead? Yes. So this is implemented in the hardware, so it's going to be much more efficient than if we implemented it in software, but it will add overhead. Numbers as far as what that overhead are, I'm not sure what a modern measurement would be, and it's a little tricky to say because modern processors are really designed to have this mapping enabled almost all the time. So it's like they've made a lot of design choices based assuming that we're doing this. Does that answer your question? But I guess I would say, I vaguely recall there was a research OS called Singularity out of Microsoft, where one of the things they did is they didn't use address spaces to implement memory protection. And in that, I think they claimed like, sometimes you have like 20-ish percent overhead. I'm not sure I believe that's true, especially for modern processors, but yeah. That would be where you'd find old numbers on this or someone was looking at the problem seriously. And it definitely depended on what type of program you were running. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we're gonna look at we talked about time multiplexing, and context switches, and our address spaces, which are going to have this option of also triggering error. And when we combine the notion of an address space, get back to that later, with this notion of like saving the registers, we get this idea of what we'll call a process. So a process is kind of this abstraction of a program, and it's composed of two other abstractions that kind of represent the hardware. So we have this thing we call thread, which is kind of this illusion you have your own CPU. So when we write our infinite loop program, we just write it as if we're going to run on a CPU that we have all to ourselves. But the actual implementation of that is that we actually share the physical CPU with other programs. But so what we get is a thread. That's the illusion that we have our own CPU with its own registers, and we don't have to worry about anything else running. And the illusion of your own memory is what we'll call the address space, right? That having this mapping set up gives you the illusion that you have all the memory. It's set up for you in particular, even though in actuality that's implemented by mixing multiple programs together in the memory. When we combine one or more threads with address space, we kind of get this virtual machine, like it's kind of like a machine that's dedicated to one program, and we call that sort of abstraction a process. Okay, so questions on this terminology? It's got this process, this sort of virtual machine that just runs one program that is what we're programming our programs to use, which is composed of threads, which are kind of our virtual processors, and the address space, which is our memory that is also virtual because it's not the real memory used with this map. Okay, so we mentioned this notion of time multiplexing. We're here. And this suggests we have an exception that's triggered when your programs run too long, and there's a whole other bunch of cases where we have these exceptions that cause the OS to run. And our textbook has this little taxonomy, which I find useful. We're not going to worry too much about the names in this taxonomy, but the taxonomy is useful for kind of giving us an overview of the kinds of events which can cause exceptions where the hardware is going to need to run the OS to do something. And at the top here, we have these two broad categories. And our top category here is what we call asynchronous exceptions. So these are cases where the OS runs despite what the program was doing. So there's nothing in the program that's triggering it, but some sort of event external to the program requires the OS to run now. And we have sort of events external to the processor are kind of a big cause of this. So one of them is a timer interrupt. And this is where the programs run too long. What will happen is when the OS starts running a program, before it switches to the program, it's going to set up a timer to trigger at some point. And when that timer triggers, it's going to cause the processor to run the OS instead of the program, and that's how the OS can enforce that programs do not run for too long. And this timer, like, it might be physically on the processor, but it's conceptually separate from the processor. It's not something the processor is doing as part of running instructions. Another big category of exceptions we'll have are to handle input and output. So, for example, when we have a key press, or when a hard drive is ready for more data to write, or when we get data in from the network, all these events require the attention of some software to communicate with that hardware. And to help support that, the processor is going to support having the hardware send a signal physically to the processor to say, hey, here's something that needs your attention, and the processor will run the OS to handle that signal. So this is for various I/O devices that the OS will need to figure out what to do about it. We have this, so that's our externally triggered category, which our textbook calls interrupts. We have this other category of asynchronous exceptions, which our textbook calls aborts, which is cases where the hardware is broken. So for example, on some hardware, you can detect that memory is not storing values correctly. And in this case, the hardware wants to tell the OS to do something about it, at least like to give an error message. And an abort is what our textbook calls the type of exception generated, but we want to run the OS when we detect that sort of hardware has failed condition, so the OS can at least display an error message, if not maybe try to do some sort of workaround or like save data or recover in some other way. So that's this asynchronous category. So this is our program isn't written to actually do anything with exceptions, but they just happen. So then we have the second category of synchronous exceptions. And these are ones where something about the instructions we were executing needs the OS's attention. And there's sort of two broad subcategories here. So one is what our textbook calls traps, which are where we're intentionally, in our program, triggering an exception, where the program is written to cause an exception to run. We'll talk about why we would need to do that later on when we talk about kernel mode. The other category is what our textbook calls faults, and this is when the program tries to run an instruction, and that instruction can't really be executed, so we need to ask the OS what to do about it. So for example, if a program tries to access memory that's not in the mapping, we're going to ask the OS, what do you want to do about that? The OS could crash the program, it could change the mapping to make the access work, but we need the OS's help to handle that. Or if we divide by zero, for example, we need the OS's help to handle that. The OS could crash the program, it could run the debugger, but the processor doesn't know what to do in that case, so it's going to ask the OS for help. And in many of these cases, the OS might just crash the program, but the OS doesn't have to do that. Because it gets to run, it gets to decide what happens. So I mentioned our timer interrupt. Some questions about sort of these categories of exceptions before we talk about sort of what the process is of actually running the OS. Yeah. So the question is, how do the errors we see from a C++ program relate to these exceptions? So exceptions in C++ or Java are not these hardware exceptions. They are a different thing, implemented in a different way. As for errors you see when you run a program, some of them are the result of an exception happening and the OS crashing the program, and then your shell, which you use like to run programs, displaying the result of that to you. So for example, when you see the message segmentation fault, probably one of these fault exceptions happened and the action the OS took was to crash the program, and then your shell, which was running the program, asked the OS, hey, what happened to the program you were running for me? And the OS said, I killed it because of a fault. And it displayed that to you as a message like segmentation fault or floating point exception or divide your bus error or something like that. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so talk about sort of one of the more common cases to illustrate these types. We'll talk about how I/O typically works. So I mentioned that like we have I/O that triggers an exception, like if I press a key, that triggers an exception. And often, and probably typically, it will be the case that the program that actually wants that key press is not running. So what will typically happen when, you know, I write a program that asks to read from the keyboard is my program that asks to read from the keyboard is first going to have to ask the OS, hey, please wait for it, data from the keyboard for me. And we'll use a deliberately triggered exception for that, which we'll call a system call. And then later on, we'll have the actual key press trigger the OS to run. And the OS will remember from that earlier system call, oh, this read input program, that was interested in this key press. Therefore, maybe I should switch to it. And this illustrates sort of one reason why we might want a deliberately triggered exception. But there's going to be a more fundamental reason why we'll want that, not even if it's not something like where our program should wait for input or something like that. So let's talk a bit about the exception implementation. So basically what the hardware needs to do is, first of all, it needs to detect that an exception happened. So in the case of a program error, some part of like our cache lookup or our instruction execution is going to say, wait, we can't run this instruction, like we're dividing by zero, or I looked up in the mapping and the mapping said it was trigger error, but something's going to say there's an exception. Or if we have an external event, like a wire coming into the processor became one instead of zero, meaning there's a might be a key press or a network packet waiting. Once that happens, the processor needs to save at least the current value of the program counter somewhere. It might also, you know, so we could also save other things. And often processors will save more than just the program counter value, but we better save the program counter value because we're going to run the OS code. How do we run code at some other location? We change the program counter. So if we don't save the program counter, we'll never remember it. And in case of like our infinite loop program, we won't know where to go back to. Right, if we think of that, you know, switching back and forth. So once we've saved it somewhere, then we're going to jump to the exception handler in the OS, and that's going to do what it needs to do. And you might say, we need to save it somewhere, so where do we save it? And there's options here. There's a bunch of options. So one option would be we could save it to like a special register. And we like have an instruction the OS could use to access that register. Another option is we could like save it on the stack or similar, or elsewhere in memory. And there's real operating systems, so real processors which do both of those options. But we need to save it somewhere, or else the OS won't be able to get it. So I'm going to describe sort of a typical exception implementation, and I will note that I'm simplifying a bunch of things that you would see, like, if you looked up how do exceptions really work on, like, x86. Like, is actually a bunch more complicated than this, but I think mostly in ways that aren't particularly useful to know for understanding sort of the purpose of exceptions and how they mostly work. So to run exception, the OS code, which we'll call exception handlers, we're going to have a table that's set up by the OS. We'll call the exception table. So this will be something in memory, and the processor needs to know where it is. So to know where it is, we'll have a special register, and we'll have special instruction to set this register. Set register, and typically done by OS on boot. So part of the boot process will be running an instruction to set this exception table base register, and the OS will set up this table with a bunch of pointers to code for each of the kinds of exception handlers. So in this example, the processor has decided that exception type index 0 is going to be our divide by 0, exception index 8 is going to be the timer interrupt, and it just assign indices to each kind of thing that might happen. And the OS gets to write whatever code it wants for each kind of event that could happen. In this case, the code the OS has decided to write starts the same for each kind of event, in that it starts by saving the values of the current registers, so the OS has registers it can use without disrupting the old register values. And that's actually a very common pattern you'll see in real OSs, is that often the first thing every exception handler will do will be to save a bunch of registers so the OS can use those registers for its own logic. And then it can restore those old register values later if it really want to go back to the same program for some reason. So this is sort of the general pattern. So we'll have this table of pointers to OS code that's going to be set up at boot, generally just set once, and then we're done. Questions on this exception table? Yeah.
So are these, I guess, pointers stored in, I mean, it's stored in like special registers, but I don't think that these are stored in actual physical memory.
Okay, question is, are the pointers stored in memory? Yes. So this register is going to be an extra register on the processor, but this table is just going to be an array in memory. And this is the most common design. Obviously, you could make a processor where you put the array on the processor, but that's typically not what's done. Other questions? Okay. And so we'll have these pointers to exception handlers, and generally the way exception handlers will work is first they're going to save the state of the currently running program, that whatever was running before the exception handler happened, and it'll handle the exception. This is very dependent on what type of exception it is. Like if it's a key press, we're going to do something very different than if it's like a divide by zero. But we'll do whatever we want to do to handle the exception, and then we're going to restore some process's state. So in the case of like a timer interrupt, typically that will be a different process than the one we saved. In the case of like, you know, say the network is ready for more data to send out, then it might be the same one typically. But we're going to restore some program state and then go back to executing a normal program. questions on the sort of general structure of exception handlers? So, and you'll see here that I have marked that we have maybe some extra instructions added to support this, like some instructions if we're saving the program counter in a special register, instructions to access that register, or and maybe a special return from exception instruction to make it easier to jump back to the program. We'll talk about why we want a special return from exception instruction a little later. But first, to introduce that, actually, let's look at sort of one case with exception. So we went back to our time multiplexing example. We said, okay, we're running our infinite loop. A timer interrupt's gonna happen. It's gonna go through that exception table. It's gonna look up the handle timer interrupt function the OS wrote. And that function, as part of its execution, is gonna terminate by restoring the state of the SSH program instead of the loop program, which means we're gonna rerun SSH instead of the loop. And I, as the author of this nice infinite loop, might say, gosh, why is the OS not running my infinite loop more? It really should be running that the whole time. Maybe I can fix that. And the whole problem is the OS is running this code, which is buggy because it doesn't keep running my infinite loop. So why don't I supply my own version of that code, which does run that infinite loop. Here we go, my timer interrupt handler. It's just gonna go back to the program. Solves the problem. So what I'll do is I'll just run that instruction the OS ran at boot to change the exception table base pointer to point to my exception table, and my exception table points to this timer interrupt handler. Great. So why can't I do this? So presumably I can't do this, because if I could, then I could log into Portal, run a program, and suddenly you can't use Portal. And hopefully that's not actually possible. At least not so trivially possible. Like, this is not, I'm not doing anything complicated here. Because, you know, this is all stuff that should be documented in the processor manual. Pretty straightforwardly. This is how you set up an exception table. And so on. So, you can write a program to do that. So here, I wrote the x86 version of the program. And the instruction on x86 to set the exception table is called LIDT for load interrupt descriptor table. There's weird historical reasons for that name. And you run this program, and to my console prints out segmentation faults. So what happened is when I tried to set a new exception table, instead of setting a new exception table, the OS got a fault, so an exception got triggered, and the OS decided in response to that exception to crash my program. So why did this operation that we know the OS did successfully earlier of changing the exception table crash my program? And that's something I had hidden on our diagram, which is what we called a privileged instruction. That some of these instructions, that especially ones that manipulate address spaces or exceptions, are ones we don't want to just let any program do. So what we want to have is we want to not let them run those instructions. And this is especially important on programs that are like shared between users. So we have the example of setting the exception table. That shouldn't be something we just let any program do. Setting the address space also shouldn't be something we just let any program do, because if we let any program set to the address space, then my program can read your program's memory. And that that would be, you know, a problem for, you know, keeping your data confidential. Or even if I just think of bugs, if my program accidentally changes the address space, then, you know, I can break the whole system. And we don't want that to be possible. We don't want, like, a buggy program to crash the whole system easily. Also, talking to an I/O device is something we generally don't want to allow programs to do directly, because we want to have that be coordinated by the OS. We don't want you to let you know, your program access the hard drive and read any file on the hard drive. If it's a shared system, we only want you to read files that are your files. So these sorts of operations are going to be restricted to privileged code. And to implement this, our processor is going to have two modes. We're going to have a kernel mode, where these privileged instructions work, and a user mode, where these privileged instructions instead cause an exception. So to implement this in our processor, we're going to have an extra 1-bit register, which will be 1 if we're in kernel mode, 0 otherwise. And we need some way of actually entering kernel mode. Because if you think of this restriction, well, you know, that stops programs from doing things if they're in user mode. But the problem is, we want to eventually, talk to the keyboard, right? Even though that might be a restricted operation, or talk to the hard drive. So how are we going to run code that actually does that, that's supposed to do that? And the mechanism we have is going to be exceptions. Our exceptions, when we run an exception handler, the hardware is going to switch to kernel mode. And when we return from an exception, we're going to write some special instructions to do that. And that's going to switch back to user mode. So this means the exception handlers in the OS, those are going to run in kernel mode. And everything else is going to run in user mode. And since the OS controls what those exception handlers do, it can make sure programs can't do things they're not supposed to do. Okay, so questions about the idea of kernel mode? So one thing which I want to mention about this that is a common point of confusion is people would say, oh, okay, so in kernel mode we can do all this stuff, in user mode we can't. I think I've seen that before. I've heard of this thing called sudo or root, and you might know of something where you could have some system where you can have some programs be able to do lots of operations, but they're still programs. So, for example, on Linux, sudo is something you can do to run a program in a way where it has more access to things than it usually does. You might say, is this how that's implemented? And the answer is no. So programs will still always run on any operating system you're used to in user mode. The difference that things like sudo or root or administrator access to it for a program will do is it's going to change how the operating system deals with requests to do operations. So since we have these privileged instructions, we need some way of actually asking the OS to do something. And the way we're going to do that is with what we'll call a system call. And on a system call, we're making a request to the operating system. And the operating system gets to decide how to handle that request. And so that's how we're going to implement that some users can do things that other users can't. And some programs can do things that other programs can't. Is that how the operating system handles requests for the kernel code, the code in kernel mode to do stuff, is going to be different. So let's talk about those requests. So I mentioned we have this notion of system calls. So there's a bunch of operations that are going to need system calls. We're going to need to make an explicit request to the operating system to say, hey, do this thing for me, because if we tried to do it directly, we would get an exception because it's a privileged instruction. And I have a list of operations here. I'm asking which ones, if we did them directly, would cause an exception in user mode, or would fail. And therefore, we need to ask the OS for help using a deliberately triggered exception. So I have a list here. Let's start with our first one. So reading data from the disk by writing the instructions to communicate with the hard disk. So who thinks that this is not going to work in user mode? Thinks this is going to work in user mode? And no clue. Okay. So I will say that this is not going to work in user mode, and one way we could have known that is we could have looked at our list of things, examples that require our curlish instructions, and I had talk to IO device. But you might say, gosh, it seems awfully inconvenient that programs can't actually talk to the hard drive. But so what would be a problem with just letting programs do that? Can someone tell me, like, why would we not want to allow that? What's something which could go wrong? Yeah.
I'm thinking about something like, you know, there's like secure data that you don't want any unauthorized users to access.
Okay. So yeah, so one issue is that the hard drive probably can't tell which programs are supposed to access which files. Can access which files, which data. So if you want to enforce that that programs running as one user can only access certain files, then we're going to need the help from the OS to do that. We can't have them talking directly to the hard drive, which likely isn't able to enforce that for us. So there's another issue we could think about. Yeah. Okay. So also, you know, more potential for bugs to overwrite data. And a third issue I can think of is that, you know, we need to make sure accesses to the hard drive are coordinated between all programs. That we can't give the hard drive conflicting instructions. Don't conflict between programs. So you want to have something doing that rather than letting the programs do it directly where they might be interfering with each other, what each other is doing. Yeah. So there's good reasons why we restrict that to user mode, and generally, and probably the biggest one is generally that, yeah, we just don't have a way of enforcing that, you know, your programs can't read other people's files unless we have the OS talk to the hard drive for you rather than letting you do it directly. Okay, how about B? Changing a program's address space to allocate it more memory. Who thinks this should fail if we attempt it directly in user mode? Okay, who thinks this should not fail if we attempt it directly in user mode? So we have consensus among the small crowd here. I would say that this should fail, and this is because, you know, the need to make sure the program can't access other programs' memory. So that's going to be a reason why we're going to want to have that operation restricted, even though it's actually it. And we have here C, returning from a standard library function. So who thinks this is likely to fail if attempted in user mode? So standard library function, to be clear, is like stringlen, printf, things in our, you know, code you don't write that you can use like any C or C++ program. Who thinks it's likely to work in attempted in user mode? And no clue? Okay. So this is likely to work. So this is a common point of confusion because we think of the standard library as part of the OS a lot of the time. And I don't think that's unreasonable, but the part of the OS that runs in kernel mode is different. And maybe another reason for this confusion is that often the standard library functions we call, something they do is they ask the OS to do something. But the way that works is that they're still normal functions that you could have written. They're just included, bundled with your program, but they're code just like the functions in your program. It just happens that code might trigger an exception internally, But the actual sort of call and return of those functions is going to be normal. And for some of those functions, they won't trigger any exception at all. So like string len, finding the length of a string, that shouldn't require asking the OS to do something with privileged instructions. Printf probably does, because we can't display stuff to the screen without help from the OS. And finally, we have last one, incrementing the stack pointer. Who thinks this is likely to fail in user mode? Likely to work in user mode? Okay, so we have most people saying it's likely to work, and I would think it's likely to work. And the point of confusion here is you might say, oh, but this allocates or deallocates memory. And that is conceptually true, but it's just changing a pointer, a register value. So, and if the address space is changed, address space mapping is changed, this happens at some other time. So there are OSs where the address space mapping will change when you allocate or deallocate stack space, but the way that will happen is that will be triggered by some other event, like trying to access memory on stack space that isn't allocated yet, or making a system call later on or something like that. But actually just changing the stack pointer, that's just an add instruction. It's not actually gonna trigger an exception. There's nothing illegal you're doing. So to do operations like allocating memory or reading or writing a file, reading input, these all these privileged instructions. So the way we're going to do them is we're going to deliberately run code in kernel mode. And to do that, we're going to deliberately trigger an exception, and this exception is going to be known as a system call. So the system call is going to be basically a normal function call. It's going to have a probably shouldn't have written, but a calling convention for the arguments and return value, but we're going to have an exception special instruction to trigger an exception for it. And a big difference we're going to have is, unlike sort of a normal function call, we can't specify the name of the function to call, like, or the address of the function to call in the normal way, because we can't just jump to some arbitrary code and start running it as an exception handler, right? The exception handlers are chosen in that table. So typically what we'll do is that we'll set a number in a register to tell the operating system, here's the operation I want to do. So for example, on 64-bit x86 Linux, they've decided that if you set REX to 0, you're asking the OS to read something for you. If you set it to 1, you're asking the OS to write something for you. If you set it to 2, you're asking it to open a file for you. And that's how we'll have to have that sort of additional information to specify the operation, rather than being able to call the right function in the OS directly. We'll have to have this extra indirection, because we don't actually know where any code is in the OS kernel mode code. All we can do is we can trigger a type of exception. So, as an example of that, here is a minimal example of a x86-64 Linux program that directly makes some system calls and prints hello world. So what we do here is we set REX to 1, and the calling convention that the Linux OS authors have chosen, it's nothing to do with the hardware, just that the people who wrote this, the exception handler, have said, we're going to look at REX to figure out what to do. So we set it to 1 to indicate to Linux that, hey, I want to do a write, and then we put the arguments in RDI, RSI, and RDX, which happens to be the same as the normal calling convention, and that's just because the people who wrote the Linux OS said, that's where I want to put the arguments, just to make things easy, but that's a choice they made. Just like for where we put arguments usually, the compiler made a choice about where it's going to read the arguments from and where it's going to put them. So same kind of choice was made, but just timed by the OS. So we put the arguments in the right place, and then we run this special instruction syscall, and that instruction just triggers an exception. It runs the exception handler in the kernel mode, because that's what an exception does. And that exception handler is going to do this operation. It's going to say, oh gosh, you want to write this string hello world, which is 15 bytes. I'm going to do that for you. It's going to do that. Then it's going to return back and continue running this hello world program. And the next thing we do is we set up for another system call where we have our operation as number 60, which is the number for exit, and our argument as 0 for exit with a return value of 0, and then we make that system call. And there's a reason I'm doing this instead of just returning, because you know, in order for to actually exit the program, we need some sort of OS intervention. We can't just return because there's nothing to return to that's outside our process, right? Because we have like kind of a virtual CPU. You know, if we return, we're still running in that same virtual processor, that thread. So you need a special instruction to do that. And I'd say, gosh, but when I'm writing C code, I just return from main. And what's happening there is usually you have the standard library is calling your main function, so you have code in the standard library to return to. But in this case, I wrote this program so it doesn't use anything in the standard library. It just is totally self-contained. So it means it can't return to anything, so it has to actually tell the OS, hey, this program's done, get rid of it. Rather than having code written to do that, that it can return to. Questions about our hello world example. So one other thing with exceptions worth noting is that often we want to write C programs that run a system call. And to help us do that, typically, the standard library is going to include functions whose entire purpose is just to make a system call. So, for example, in my example program here, you can write in C, you can write code like this that will make a similar system call. And because of that, people will say, oh, write is a system call. The write function is a system call. And it's not actually a system call. So if there's this write function you call, which sort of has the same effect as this code here, well, what happened is someone wrote an assembly function called write, and it basically just, it makes a system call inside it. And that's basically all it does. But to do that, like at first, you know, sets up the arguments and sets the return value at the end. So it's a function whose purpose is to convert your C function call into a system call. So these functions are common. I will call them system call wrappers. And the main thing I want you to be aware of them is that, I guess two things, is one is that if you want to make a system call, probably you want to call one of these wrapper functions rather than writing assembly, because writing assembly is annoying. And the other thing is that if you're calling one of them, you aren't actually making a system call directly, there's a little bit of indirection. Right. So you can't actually, you aren't calling the OS directly, you're calling a function that runs the OS. Okay. Questions about the question is, sort of, I here said I can achieve the same effect as this particular code here that makes a write system call by calling this function called write. Like, how is that different than calling printf, as you were saying? Yeah, so on Linux, the write system call, that is the This is the operation that the operating system implements. So there's some higher level operations like printf, you mentioned, that are like more flexible and implemented by eventually calling operations like write. So write is the low level basic operation, that's what the OS implements. And often we have a standard library that will implement more convenient things on top of that, and printf is a good example of that. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so before I finish up exceptions, so one other note about kernel mode. So I kind of said, oh, kernel mode, you know, it just changes sort of what instructions we can do. But we have a bit of a problem if that's all it changes. And that's that, well, if we're thinking of our exception table, that's a thing that's in memory. And if we're thinking of our exception handlers, those are in memory. And we need something to stop programs from modifying that. And you might say, okay, well, we have this mapping of addresses, so can't we just not have the, you know, exception table or the, you know, actual exception handlers in that mapping? And the answer is no, because the mapping's still going to be active when the exception handler runs. And so generally, when you look at the this one, look at the mapping of programs I've shown you, I have this region labeled as used by OS. And typically, this sort of region will be the same in every program that's running, every process. And some part of this, like, will be the exception table. And some part of this will be the, you know, exception handlers. And all their data. And you might say, gosh, if this is in every program's memory, what prevents the programs from just changing that? Right? We said we couldn't change where the exception table base pointer is, but it sounds like we can edit the exception table. And the answer is that our mapping is going to prohibit that by having an additional piece of information that it specifies, which is that some addresses can be specified as kernel mode only. So there's some addresses which are going to be valid to access when kernel mode is on with the same mapping, but not when the mapping's in user mode. That's typically how we'll prevent that from happening, but still have like all our OS's data loaded in the current mapping that's set up. Some questions about kernel mode only mappings? So to finish up exception. So we have a bunch of list of operations here. And my question is, which of these requires some sort of exception to happen? And which of these requires some sort of context switch to happen? So our first one here is a program calls a function in the standard library. So who thinks this requires some sort of exception to happen? Who thinks this does not require some sort of exception to happen? Okay, so most people think it doesn't. I would say this is no exception. And this is a common point. So no exception for the call. But the library function might trigger an exception after being called. So as an example, that write function I showed you talked about earlier, that would be a library function. And actually just calling that function doesn't actually trigger any exceptions in the call itself, but the function might do something that uses an exception. Now, some library functions definitely won't cause an exception. So for example, stringlen is a library function. Hopefully, to find out where the null terminator on a string is, we don't have to switch to the OS. So it might trigger it, but it definitely doesn't require an exception. But this is a point of confusion because there are a lot of library functions which do make a system call because they're doing something that a verb can't do directly, but not all of them, and definitely not as a result of the call directly. Just something that happens after the call actually starts. Okay. So how about, and there's no context switch involved. In the general case, sometimes there might be a context switch, like if you're exiting, of course, that will probably trigger a context switch. Which I probably shouldn't have said. Okay, so B. So program writes to a file on a file to disk. So who thinks this requires an exception? Thinks this does not require an exception? Okay, I would say exception, and this is to communicate with the disk. So we mentioned earlier that we probably can't let programs talk to the disk directly, so they're going to have to do it by having the OS help out. So they'll have a deliberately triggered exception to do that at a minimum. We might also have some additional exceptions involved, like if the disk is telling the OS, hey, I'm ready for more data now, that might be done by triggering an interrupt, you know, having the OS take care of that in the middle of some other program running. How about, and I would say there's no context switch for this case necessary. So no context switch needed to do this. Okay, how about C? Program A goes to sleep, letting program B win. So who thinks this requires an exception? Thinks this does not require an exception? Okay, so we have a split. Who thinks this requires a context switch? Thinks this does not require a context switch. Okay, so we have agreement that this requires a context switch. So this is definitely a context switch. This is kind of like almost the definition of a context switch. And generally, to do a context switch between two processes, we're going to need an exception. And one reason we can think about that is one of the things we want to do is we want to change the mapping of addresses. And that's going to be a privileged operation. You aren't just going to let any program change the current mapping to access other program stuff. So yes, exception. You know, so one reason is to change the sort of address mapping for space. So that mapping. Another reason is that program A shouldn't be allowed to access program B's stuff, generally. Right, if we think of our programs not being able to interfere with each other, like my program can't just crash another program, probably we need the OS's help for that reason, too. But definitely, just to change the address space, you know, we can't do that ourselves. So we aren't going to be allowed to like just change the mapping arbitrarily. Okay, how about a program X sends? Is this going to require an exception? Thinks yes. Thinks no. Okay, how about a context switch? Who thinks yes? Thinks no. So I would say this probably is. I would say, yes, this requires a context switch because if the program's exited, we can't keep running it. And yes, this would require an exception. First of all, because the context switch requires an exception because we need to like change the address mapping. Another reason why is because we need to clean up the operating system's like internal data about the program, and presumably we don't just allow any program to write to that, or else one program could crash a bunch of other programs. So I would say yes, exception, sort of edit OS's bookkeeping data plus change address spaces. So questions about that? Okay. Let's go to E. So a program returns from one function to another function. Thinks this is going to require an exception? Thinks this is not going to require an exception? Okay. Who thinks this is going to require a context switch? Thinks this is not going to require a context switch? Okay, so most people say no exception, no context switch. So I think there's two points of confusion here. So one is that you can kind of think of, you might say, oh, when I return from a function, I deallocate stuff. And this is kind of conceptually true. Like, we just say that there's some part of the stack we're no longer using, but we don't actually immediately, like, actually give that space back for other programs, which means the address space mapping we have is not going to actually change from the return instruction. Because all the return instruction's doing is reading a value from the stack and jumping there. Right, so it's not doing any operation that actually requires privilege, and it's not actually freeing up the memory. It's just changing, you know, where a pointer is in this memory that's already allocated. So I would say no exception. Sort of just jump plus change pointers. Change pointers, sort of no memory deallocation is done. Is like necessary to do that. Context switch, a point of confusion is that if you know how function calls work, you might say, oh, part of returning from a function is like popping a bunch of registers. And that kind of looks like a context switch. And it is very related, right? So one thing we do with functions is we like kind of save some stuff to restore later. That is kind of like a context switch. When I refer to a context switch, I mean we're saving the whole thing, all this context. We aren't like just like saving and storing little pieces, yeah, that we're overwriting. So that's just a definitional thing. So it's not a real context switch. So this is, even though, yes, we might be saving and restoring a few registers. In particular, usually we don't consider it a context switch if we aren't saving and restoring the program memory. Because that's kind of the most important part that makes it a context as opposed to just a bunch of saved values. Questions about that? Okay, finally, a program pops a value from the stack. Who thinks this requires an exception? A context switch. So we have consensus on that. And it's the same thing about returning. Is that even though conceptually it might like deallocate memory, it doesn't actually do that. If that happens, that happens in some other way. Questions? Yeah.
So if you push a value to the stack, does that require an exception?
Question, if you push a value to the stack, does it require exception? Usually not. Because usually the address you're pushing to will already be set up in your memory. If it's not for some reason, then it would. And we'll talk about that probably next week. But if it's already set up in your mapping, which is the common case, then no exception will happen. Okay, so notice terminology. So I have this chart here of like different names for exceptions that our textbook uses. And I didn't spend much time going over the names. And the reason for that is that the real world is horrible about this. So I'm following the textbook's terms for exceptions, but the real world calls every part of exceptions different things. So for example, if you're reading the x86 manuals from Intel, they'll use the term interrupt for all exceptions. They'll refer to faults as exceptions and interrupts for exceptions, what our textbook calls exceptions. And other processor manuals will do different things. There is not consistency. You like see the term hard fault, but it means an abort, not like an actual synchronous exception. You'll see the term trap used to refer to faults, like a, you know, memory out of bounds trap instead of a fault. So the terminology in the real world is not consistent, which is why I'm not going to require you to memorize the textbook's terms. I want you to know sort of the categories, but I don't care that you know their names. I want you to know what kinds of events can trigger exceptions. And I also want you to know that if you're like reading some documentation for an operating system or a processor, and you see the word interrupt or exception, you need to do some work to figure out what they really mean by that. Because they could mean like all exceptions or a particular kind. You need to look at the context. Hopefully, if it's a processor manual, like they'll have the definitions that should tell you what they really mean. And there's a similar issue, though not as bad, with the term kernel mode. So I use the term kernel mode. You might see this also called supervisor mode, or privileged mode, or ring zero. Also, there's some systems that have multiple levels of privilege. Basically, there will be like a mode where all the privileged operations work, and a mode where some of them work, but not all of them. It's kind of in between kernel and user mode. So questions on terminology? Okay, so in our last 8 minutes, I'll do our brief introduction to pages, which will be our main topic, virtual memory and paging, which will be our main topic next week. So you mentioned we have this mapping. So we have some addresses processes use, which we'll call virtual addresses. And this is every address a process uses. And I really mean every address, instructions and data. You can't, in your program, write an address and have it not be a virtual address. They're all virtual addresses. So every address you use is going to go through this mapping set up by the US. And we're going to talk about sort of the basic form of that mapping. And that mapping goes to real addresses, which we'll call physical addresses. And one thing I'll note, which will come up in our examples, is that these addresses could have different sizes. So the virtual addresses can be smaller or larger than the physical addresses, and that's fine, because we're using this mapping to figure out how to interpret them. So let's look at sort of a way we can store this, and we're gonna, do a very simple toy version today, and we'll sort of expand that to something more practical next week. So for our toy version, I have a program here which has a very small virtual memory. So this is the addresses it can access. And it has 10 bits of addresses it can access. And I've divided those 10 bits of addresses up into 4 chunks. And I'm going to call these chunks pages. And these pages are of equal size. And I'm going to number the pages starting at the lowest address. It's going to be numbered 0, then 1, then 2, then 3. And very deliberately, I've chosen these pages to be a size which is a power of 2. And that's a very deliberate choice, which has some very nice consequences. And the biggest consequence is, because I chose them to be a power of 2, if I look at the upper bits of the address, that matches exactly to the numbering I just did for these chunks. So page 0, the first chunk, is all the things where the first 2 bits of the address are 0, because I chose a power of 2 size. Page 1 is all the things where the first 2 bits are 0, 1, and so on. And that's just a consequence of me choosing the size of the pages to be a power of 2. And we'll call those upper bits of the address the page number. And if we have a name for the upper bits of the address, we'll have a name for the rest of the address. We'll call the page offset. So this is our location within one of these pages, these chunks. So it starts at 0 and goes up to all 1s. We have that for every chunk. So this is how our program's view of memory works. And in this case, I've also decided that the first chunk here I'm going to use for code, the second part I'm going to use for its data and its heap, the third part I'm going to use for extra heap if I need it, otherwise it's going to be empty, and then I have the stack. I've just chosen arbitrarily, this is how I'm going to lay out the program among these chunks, which we call pages. Now, to actually make our mapping, we're going to have our physical addresses, our real memory addresses, and I'm going to divide them up into pages again. So I'm going to have chunks of the same size. So in this case, physical addresses, I should say, are more plentiful than my virtual addresses. So I have more pages of them, because the page size is the same between both of them. But because I chose my page size to be a power of 2, I can still look at these upper bits of the addresses and these pages to figure out what the page number is, and I'll have numbers for these physical address pages. And I need to set my mapping, and the way we're going to set up our mapping that the processor will use is that we'll take whole pages of virtual addresses and map them to whole pages of physical addresses. So I'm just going to say here that this first page here, the ones where my addresses start with 2 zeros, is going to map to the physical page where my addresses start with 3 ones. So I'm going to map from virtual page 0 to physical page 7. And I'm also going to say that virtual page 1, this second piece here, I've just chosen is going to map to physical page 2. Or not, 2, 3, sorry, yeah, 2. Because this is 0, 1, 2, up to 7. And I haven't mapped virtual page 2 to anything, but I've mapped virtual page 3 to physical page 0. So I've just chosen a mapping, so just assign each virtual page to a physical page or to none. Now, I can't actually tell the processor about this mapping by drawing this picture. It is not a format of input my processor accepts, unfortunately. So instead, we're going to make a table. So we're going to have a table with an entry for each physical page, and we're going to fill in that table, for each virtual page. So for each chunk of the program's memory, I'm going to fill in what physical page, if any, that gets assigned to. And this is the information we're going to supply to the processor. So questions about this idea of doing this mapping of dividing memory up into these fixed size pages and mapping the virtual pages, the ones the program can see, to physical pages? Yes.
So then the diagram, the 0, 0 virtual address is mapped like 2 and 7, but on the table it's only mapped 2 and 5.
And the table is in the address it's mapped. Address virtual address 0 is mapped to 2. I only see 2 here. 1 is mapped to 7. Sorry if I misspoke. Is virtual address 0 up? Yes.
Is this still like in process of mapping from virtual physical, because the virtual page 2 apparently hasn't been assigned to physical?
So the question is, how does virtual page 2 not being assigned to anything work? So that's going to correspond to the case we alluded to earlier of this trigger error option. So when we don't have anything to put there, it's going to trigger an exception instead, because the processor, well, doesn't know what to do otherwise. So it's going to trigger an exception. Other questions? Yeah. Question, is this mapping arbitrary for the example? Yes. And in practice, this mapping, which we call a page table, this is something the operating system can configure however it wants. Obviously, the operating system has some restrictions if it wants the program to work correctly, but otherwise, the operating system is free to set this up however it wants. So we're going to have this in our processor, and there's one thing, you mentioned that, you were asking about the none. We can't actually write none like in a register or something like that. So we'll actually have an extra column for marking things as valid or invalid, just like with caches. And what the processor is going to do is going to have a table like this. We'll talk next time about how it's actually stored, which is going to become a little complicated. And it's going to take the address the program uses. It's going to take off the page number part, which we'll call the virtual page number, use that to look up a page table entry, an entry in this table, and based on that entry, we'll figure out, do we have an out of bounds access? Do we need to trigger an error because it's not valid mapping? Otherwise, it will take the physical page number and combine that with the rest of the address, the page offset, to actually access the cache for memory. So questions about this sort of translation idea? Okay, So we'll talk more about this next week, where we'll figure out how to deal with the fact that it turns out it's not really practical to store the table like this because it's going to be way bigger than it fits on the slide. Let's see.